people a sacrament for me. There are only two sacraments. Willem and I should, before we go on, you should be recalled as having insisted that Christ changed marriage. That's important. He changed marriage by laying down especially the grave obligation of monogamy. That was a watershed, as it were, which divided the Old and the New Testaments. And as he says, among the differences between the Old and the New, monogamy is more drastic than changing polygamy and the right to remarry after divorce to absolute, indissoluble monogamy. And then he argues, inasmuch as Christ laid this heavy mandate on human nature, which hasn't changed, human nature is the same in the New Testament as in the Old, he must, in justice, he said, have guaranteed, not merely promised, but guaranteed, strength and grace in virtue of marriage, which the people in the Old Law did not receive. And the moment you say that, the moment you say guarantee of grace built into the contract, anyhow, that was Bellarmine's basic argumentation. Then on the score of impediments, I think we said something about that. We didn't quite finish the lineup. Remember, the basic issue there with the reformers was the denial on one part, the affirmation on the other, of the churches having the right to dictate impediments to marriage. Now, impediments are those things which, in this context, would nullify or invalidate a marriage contract. Age, which of course is obvious enough, relationship, both physical relationship and spiritual relationship. And the church therefore had a right, and she still believed. And for example, in states where, say, the marriageableness or the validity for the marriage of a girl is as low as 12 in some states of the United States, nevertheless, because canon law recognizes nothing under 14 if a Catholic girl should marry under the age of 14, even though the state says she is validly married because she was 13 years old, in the eyes of the church, she is not married. In other words, these impediments stand, civil laws to the contrary notwithstanding. That's the issue. The whole question of baptism and the necessity of a person's being baptized to contract the sacrament follows logically from the church's teaching on baptism having to be, well, first received before a person can receive the sacrament of matrimony. And therefore, the church has always considered as invalid marriages between people who are baptized and those who are not baptized unless she gives a dispensation. And it is well to know that while most Protestants would certainly not even advert to it, nevertheless, from the Council of Trent on, the Catholic Church has given an implicit dispensation to those who are not Catholic, who nevertheless may marry with one, say, who is not baptized. So the contract is valid, but only on the strength of a dispensation. And in this context, it is also well to notice that already from Trent on, the kinds of dispensation which the Church would give for a marriage between two people who are, well, baptized, one of whom is a Catholic, was different than between two people, one of whom is a Catholic and the other is not baptized. In one case, the first, the dispensation is required indeed, but not for the validity of the contract. Suppose no dispensation is got for a marriage between a Catholic and, say, a Methodist or a Presbyterian. Nevertheless, the contract is valid. Whereas, where the one party is Catholic and the other not baptized, and if no dispensation is got or was got surreptitiously or falsely or otherwise, the contract is not valid. Suggesting the Church's concern for preserving the faith and therefore making it correspondingly more difficult for people who are not of the faith to marry validly. The whole business of capacity for marriage. Now, this has developed since the time of Bellarmine. Nevertheless, The basic principles were already there in the time of Trent. In fact, we go all the way back to the beginning of Christian times. The general rule always held and taught in Catholic Christianity was, and still is, that people who are incapable of intercourse, physically incapable of intercourse, cannot marry, and no dispensation is ever given. No matter how much they are in love, no matter what other qualities or compatibility they may have, if they are incapable of physical intercourse, then no dispensation is given. And that, behind that concept, of course, stands the notion of the primary purpose of marriage. However, even though, say, a couple is incapable of bearing children, or at least either the wife or the husband is sterile, but provided intercourse is possible, then that marriage is valid, and in fact no dispensation is even required. Sterility, therefore, sterility does not invalidate marriage, in fact, can be a perfectly valid marriage, and even no dispensation is required. But the business of incapacity, or impotence, as it is commonly called, this is the Church's teaching, and does not always jive with civil authority or civil laws, which by this time, almost 100 years of the Reformation, had been in effect, and often were quite different from the Catholic position. Finally, I have the term virtue here. This covers the whole gamut of impediments where, if there are certain disqualifying conditions in one or either party as regarding their virtue, and what this means basically is that such a thing as adultery would invalidate a subsequent contract. The Church is concerned, therefore, for preserving the sanctity of marriage in the sense that, suppose a couple is married and a couple is married and one had committed adultery with a partner or a person whom they had hoped to marry. Well, the party with whom the adultery was committed, would have a stain against their honor or virtue, which would be by itself an impediment to subsequent marriage, unless a dispensation were got.
In adultery prior to the marriage? Is that what
you're... Well, this would be adultery, yes, prior to a subsequent marriage. Obviously, if there had been a valid marriage in the first case, they couldn't get a dispensation. But if a person who had committed adultery, he being eligible to marry, and then wanted to marry somebody else, that would be at least an impediment of honor. Also, and this, of course, is something we see so often nowadays, where, at least often enough in the newspapers, of the death of one of the persons, if there is any suspicion of either partner, of course, the partner who wanted release from the marriage bond, conniving at the death of his partner, that not only would invalidate the contract, but if recognized, the Church would not give a dispensation for the subsequent, that is, remarriage of one who had somehow been suspected of conniving at the death of his first partner. On this business of virtue, too, now this touches on the essence of the contract, and that is that the couple, as we saw when we were examining marriage under the aspect of a contract, where one of the conditions for a valid contract, of course, is full and complete knowledge of who is being married or whom I am marrying. And consequently, a man or a girl may ask or even require certain knowledge about, say, the condition of the person they are marrying. And while that's not normally done, but if it were laid down as a condition, and the man told the girl, I would not marry you unless, and she deceives him, then that marriage could later on be invalidated or declared null and void because it is legitimate to lay down the condition of whom I want to marry. The whole thing being, the whole complex, suggesting and indicating, in fact, the Church's belief that she has quite complete jurisdiction over the marriage of baptized people. Dispensation, just a distinction that Bellarmine makes. First, between positive law and divine law. Now, there are certain positive laws. Take the business of age. Take the matter of certain relationships. For example, it is very rare that the Church would ever give a dispensation for the marriage of first cousins. Nevertheless, for reasons serious enough, such a dispensation can be got. Now, that would be considered a positive law, not a divine law. One of my Jesuit brethren, a professional biologist doing some work for the government in the Chicago, Greater Chicago area, spent about 2 years, not all of the years, but at least quite some time under a government grant, studying the progeny, the children of close marriages, extremely close marriages, first cousins and the like, where dispensation had been got from the Church for such marriages, not commonly known, and he had access to the files of the Catholic Chancery, and as a consequence, he could trace those. Now, his purpose was, such, by the way, as being done in various parts of the country, a constant examination being made to, strange, to test the effect of atomic fallout on the American nation, or the American people. Millions are being spent in research to test how greatly the infiltration of the air with atomic fission affects the genetic process. See, that's the gravest effect of atomic fission on the atmosphere. It tends to sterilize progeny, or sterilize the genetic faculty. Or if not sterilize, at least to affect, so that there is some kind of malformation in children, second and third generation. Now, there is a connection, as you know, between inbreeding and the possibility of certain characteristics coming out. At any rate, as a test against the number of malformations or other genetic difficulties arising from inbreeding, see, as a kind of a standard or test, this was being done, and a priest scientist was hired because only he would have access to the files to know who was so closely married and would be willing to cooperate and tell, for example, explain everything, and then that information would be used as the background for testing in the next 25 or 30 years the effect on the genes of atomic fallout. Anyhow, just to illustrate that, there are positive laws from which the Church dispenses, such as close marriages, without, of course, ever see a thing like a brother and sister marriage, which would be considered part of the divine law, and therefore absolutely forbidden. The divine law, Bellarmine further distinguished in the marriage dispensations, between natural and gospel, or revealed and New Testament revealed. From this, the Church cannot give a dispensation. And therefore, say the right to remarry after a previous marriage between two baptized people, the right to remarry after such a marriage had been contracted and consummated, is believed by the Church to be of divine law, and therefore no dispensation is possible. And to read the record of history, say the concern that Pius V had for years studying the case of the he was prior to Pius V, Sixtus V, and Pius V too, regarding the remarriage in England, first of Henry VIII, and of other concessions that had been given by the Archbishop of Canterbury, who by that time had been an Anglican. And once a marriage had been proved to have been contracted and consummated by baptized people, even though the loss of the nation was at stake, dispensation couldn't be given. Indissolubility, in the eyes of the Catholic Church, so Bellarmine argued, The absolute indissolubility arises from the teaching of Christ and the command laid upon the human race once baptized by Christ. And therefore, while we have in all other nations of the world, even those that receive God's revelation, like the Jews, there is no law, pardon me, there is no nation that has a law of absolute monogamy. No laws of any human institution until Christianity came along to make the right to remarry after a previous marriage contrary to the law of God. In other words, monogamy is a unique Christian mandate. And from that, no dispensation is possible. Now, by that time, as we mentioned, I think in this class, certainly we know, by that time, divorce had been allowed by the early reformers for two reasons: for infidelity and for willful desertion. But already by the time of the death of Luther in 1546, especially the second, the willful desertion had been so broadly interpreted that you find not too much difference between the concessions and the right to remarry after previous marriage and divorce. Not too much difference between, say, mid-16th century thought and mid-20th century. In other words, in 50 years, the disinhibitability of marriage had been revolutionized. It does not mean that those laws had become so widely applied or people in general had got divorces. No. The beginnings were made in the continent, spread to England, then under the Cromwellian regime had become much more widespread, became part of the complex of colonial law, later in the United States, blossomed forth into what we now consider rightly the gravest blight on American family life. But the tradition for upwards of 200 years, especially on the continent, even though the concessions had been made and divorces were being granted with the right to remarry, yet the tradition had been pretty much to stay together, especially in Germany. Now, on celibacy and virginity, Bellarmine spent close to a whole volume for the simple reason that among the early reformers, notably Luther, there were quite a few who had been in monks in monasteries. And as you know, the woman that Luther married had been a nun. And many of the writings of Luther especially are studied polemics against virginity and celibacy. And this is the judgment of Lutherans themselves. There are whole sections of Luther on this subject that do not appear in English or in other vernacular translations. In other words, the disclaimer of its being possible to remain so, to remain chaste. And if those who vow themselves to this kind of a life are not hypocrites, they are worse. Now, Bellarmine, in defending Christian virginity as a consecrated state of life, appealed first and foremost to the example of Christ, who, as we of course know, did not marry, and whose life, therefore, is not only a series of instructions to what he taught, but also a pattern for those who want to follow his example in Christian perfection. Then over the centuries, Bellarmine points out, some of the greatest figures in Christian history had been celibate. And why it is true that the Roman tradition, that is the Roman Rite, R-I-T, in the Catholic Church, did not make celibacy mandatory on its clergy until the 11th century. Nevertheless, all the way back to Elvira, which I think is 331 in Spain, there had already been laws enforcing, for Spain at least, the laws of celibacy, indicating the tradition going all the way back. In the Eastern Church, as I'm sure you know, the distinction had been made, over the centuries still is made, of those who are monks in monasteries who take the vow of celibacy, the vow of chastity as it is called, and the parish clergy, who by and large are not celibate, but who marry and as married men may become priests. Bellarmine defends the theology of celibacy and virginity, both on the score of its being possible from, you might say, the fact that people have done it, and they were not necessarily psychotic or otherwise. But also, and importantly, as with monogamy, he argues to the existence of a new law. In other words, what was impossible indeed, and we cannot appeal, he said, to the Old Testament. What was, or maybe considered to have been, relatively speaking, impossible, because God did not give his grace in the old dispensation, in the new, almost the symbol of the amount of grace that God gives in the new dispensation is the law of monogamy that he placed upon marriage, and the counsel of virginity that he offered to those who wished to take it. In other words, what is impossible to nature is possible to grace. And Bellarmine waxes eloquent on the test of Christianity being the practice of chastity. Because this, more than anything else, shows not only in theoretical terms, but in one's own flesh, the power of God's grace over fallen human nature, which cannot, not a question of difficulty, it cannot remain chaste either through fidelity in marriage or least of all through celibacy outside of marriage. Now let's take up the subject of eschatology, which is, as I'm sure you know, the study of the last things. Eschaton in Greek means of or the last thing, and eschata are the last things. Last in the sense of the last of a series. They may also be called the newest things, because normally what is last in one series becomes the first in a new. Anyhow, eschatology is the science of the last things, normally in popular Christian thought, death, judgment, heaven, and hell. Now what we want to do in today's final class, appropriately dealing with the last things, is to take up the three figures that we are studying or have been studying. It's fast becoming the historical perfect. Augustine, Aquinas, and a little look at Bellarmine, who did not much add to eschatology, except in the Counter-Reformation controversy over the existence of purgatory. Now, in many ways, this is one of the most satisfying features of Christian tradition, Christian thought. Because it is this which, on the one hand, buoys up the Christian's hope, it gives meaning to his life, and it gives him that salutary fear which everyone needs to follow the straight and narrow. First of all, Augustine, and we'll take him in four sections, where there are specific classic passages dealing with a subject, I will identify them in general, just tell you that he handles this subject in various works. Now we are presuming, of course, the existence of heaven, hell, and of course the fact of death. The existence of purgatory is naturally controverted among Christians and is a distinctively Catholic teaching, and Augustine comes into his own there too. Consequently, we're not going to cover the whole panoply of eschatology. That, by the way, is a semester course, and we are spending less than a period. First, regarding death. Augustine regularly, especially in his anti-Pelagian writings, remember for keeps, who the Pelagians were. They were those who denied what?
The necessity of grace.
The necessity of grace. See, there are about six things I want to make sure you don't forget in this course.
Or the other five.
You'll find out in Father's test. This, by the way, will be one. See? This will be one. So, the Pelagians denied the necessity of grace. But behind their denial of the necessity of grace was their denial of what? Of the original sin. See? Because basically the necessity for grace is the fact that man has fallen, at least the remedial grace. And consequently, once they denied that man inherited original sin, and they couldn't deny that people died, I mean, they wouldn't be heretics, they would be psychopaths. And there is a difference. They admitted the existence of death, they denied original sin. What do they logically have to say? That, Mike?
That's
please? Well, not judgment, but in terms of death. What about death? What does Christian tradition teach about death? It is the consequence of original sin. So, Augustine's concern was to prove that death was the result of sin. So, this is the concern there, and it was against the Pelagians. Where? The Pelagians deny the existence of original sin as something transmitted or communicated from Adam to his progeny. The Pelagians said, death is the natural dissolution of the body. Adam's sin has less than nothing to do with death. He would have died, we would have died, had Pelagius, or rather had Pelagius, had Adam not sinned. It would have made no difference. Now regarding heaven. As regarding the Pelagian doctrine, remember for the Pelagians, the necessity of grace was not only consequent on their denial, or the non-necessity was not only consequent on the denial of sin. In other words, we don't need grace because we are not sinners. They were much more heretical than that. They didn't just deny that we don't have original sin, therefore we don't need remedial grace. They claimed that man was never elevated to a higher than a natural order. And therefore the heaven to which everyone aspires is something which is due to human nature. See? And it is for this fundamental reason that they are called Pelagians, or they are called the deniers of grace. Because the reason, as Augustine pointed out, why we need grace basically is not only because we are fallen, we sure need it for that reason, but because we are human. Consequently, if we receive grace, and grace is the means of getting to heaven, then, in terms of heaven, for the Pelagians, it is something which is due to a person. All he's got to do is use his will, his willpower. See? It is not as though God had raised man to a higher than a natural destiny through his infusion of grace, and therefore heaven is a gift twice over. The Pelagians denied its being a gift beyond the fact that God did not have to make the human race in the first place. Then against the Manichaeans and the Originists. Originists were the followers of Origen. It is almost certain that Origen did not teach this, but his followers certainly did. The Manichaeans also taught it, the claim that everyone will ultimately be saved. And I think we have one or two universalist churches in Kalamazoo, I'm not sure. Anybody know?
One.
That's about the quota for a community this size. They believe, the universalists, and they go all the way back to the ancient Manichaeans. Everyone, demons and the wicked, will eventually be saved. They're all going to go to heaven eventually. Finally, hell will close up. And when they speak, or in other words, the term eternal or everlasting is found in the Gospels about hell, well, they say hell is eternal in the sense it will last as long as there's anybody there. Augustine, he insisted that not everybody will be saved. That not only is a heaven and a hell, there always will be a heaven and a hell, and there will always be somebody in each place. Now that universalism, notice, does not mean that everybody can be saved. That kind of universalism Augustine taught. See? The opposite, of course, is absolute predestination, which is not Augustine. but that everybody will be saved, that Augustine denied. Then inequality. And here he especially in his commentaries on the parables in the Gospel, which suggest some kind of eventual both equality and inequality, Augustine, in those contexts, in commenting on the parables of the Gospels, points out on the one hand, as for example, in the parable of the penny, the workers, remember, at different times worked different lengths of time and each got a penny, which doesn't sound like much with our modern, organized CIO and AFL, but in those pre-civilized times, they figured that was enough. Augustine argues from Christ's parable that the penny means that everybody's going to get to heaven. At heaven, you're happy. You've got enough to last you for all eternity in heaven. But though the penny would correspond to that which everybody gets when he gets to heaven, yet not everyone is going to be equally happy in heaven. Now this is significant for Augustine, with all of his stress on grace. And his argument is a very simple one. Why make any extra effort? If it's just a question of getting into heaven, there are ways of getting there without all this heroism and so on that Christ, especially as he comments in the Beatitudes, of going beyond the call of duty. Anyhow, corresponding to the generosity, there is a reward. There is a position that Augustine taught that has since been abandoned in Catholic theology, and that is that both soul and body will directly enjoy the beatific vision. That is not taught now in Catholic circles. It is only the soul, not the body. The body will have its own joys, but not the beatific vision. That's reserved for the soul. There is also a position in Augustine that has since been abandoned, and that is, he was sure that people who are saved will be in heaven before the last judgment. He was a little less sure about their complete beatitude. That is, he figured there was a real difference in the intrinsic, essential joy of a soul before and after the last judgment. That too has been abandoned. In other words, a person can, reaching heaven, once he gets there, he has a right to all the joys thereof. That was settled in the 13th century, which means about almost 800 years after Augustine. Both that only the soul directly enjoys the beatific vision, and secondly, even a moment after death, provided the soul is completely cleansed of sin, it may enjoy the fullness of beatitude. Of course, not yet with the body. On the eternity of heaven, and here he is, especially in book 12 of the City of God, which has a lot to do with heaven. And I have the passage here, 12:13:1, book 12, chapter 13, paragraph or section 1. He says that heaven must be eternal, otherwise it's not heaven. Because if there is anything that would alloy or adulterate happiness, it is even the remotest fear that this thing is going to end. He said, that's the trouble with life on this earth. The happier you are, in a way, the more pathetic it is, because you know it's going to end. Heaven must be eternal. Because, he says, the mind can conceive perpetual happiness and always conceives it as of endless duration. It would not be perfect happiness if it ended. Now on purgatory, and this, by the way, is well to know that over the centuries, and especially the Council of Trent, in the Counter-Reformation, I did, of course, appeal to the scriptures, certain passages that we will see in Bellarmine. Nevertheless, it's, you might say, prize witness for the existence and nature of purgatory was Augustine. Saint Augustine taught the existence of purgatory. For example, in his Confessions, when he is speaking about his mother, Monica, describing her death and his great love for her, then he more than observes, he has a whole section there in which he speaks of his praying and offering masses for her, not because she was not a good woman, but because, having known her, he observes certain defects of character for which, perhaps, she might still be suffering, and he wanted to make sure that his mother got to heaven as quick as possible. Now, what are, first of all, where in St. Augustine is purgatory most explicitly taught? It is taught in, of course, the Confessions that I mentioned before. It is in his Anti-Pelagian writings, but especially in the City of God, Book 21. Book 21 of the City of God treats of purgatory, of its existence, and of its nature. There is one passage in that section where he says, there are some people suffer temporally only in this life, and then no more sufferings. And he says, that's the best. Others, he says, suffer only, now this is a slight exaggeration, but it was good Augustinian hyperbole, suffer only in the life to come. In other words, they've squeezed every juice, every drop of pleasure from this life. All their suffering is after death. Well, they probably had at least a pang of conscience before death. Anyhow, he credits them with not having suffered in this life. And some, he said, suffer temporally always, see, both in this life and in the next. In other words, those who, I suppose, happen to be most of the human race, that is subject to a certain amount of vicissitude in this life, yet not having served God perfectly, may also suffer after death. He is the one who is the greatest witness of the Church for the fire in purgatory, which we will briefly talk about when we come to Bellarmine. He calls it the ignis, which is fire, emendatorius, the amending, the fire that makes amendments, it gets the amendment out of you. He also speaks of the ignis purgatorius, and of course it means the cleansing fire. This, I should say, he is not, in so many words, has not been defined by the Catholic Church that there are fires in purgatory. Augustine did, at some length, and especially as we mentioned in the Confessions, he did teach that prayers can be offered for the souls in purgatory, and that those who are with God can be invoked, can be prayed to, in the sense of interceded for, or interceded from and for. And his argument was, there were some people, as he put it, I have a quotation here, there are some people who were evidently not so good as to have gone immediately to heaven, therefore it's wise to pray for them, and they are not so bad that there's no use praying for them because they're in hell. Therefore, that's, they can both be prayed for because they are suffering and can be relieved, and can be interceded with because they are with God. The effect of those suffrages, the word, by the way, of praying for the deceased, is technically in Catholic theology called suffrage, suffrages. It really means a praying for, a request for. And this has been the constant teaching of Catholicism ever since, and even before, although he explicitated it. The function or the purpose of these supplications is both to lessen the duration and the intensity. Now, the second part is perhaps less commonly known, lessen the intensity of suffering. There is a passage, there are two, in fact, in the, I might just as well mention, the 21st book, both of them, of the City of God, chapter 13 and chapter 16, in which he speaks at some length about purgatory lasting only to the last judgment. See, no more purgation after the last day, which wouldn't appear so obvious at first blush. Now the change, not so much change, but at least you might say the definitive position of the Catholic Church on the fires of purgatory, which Augustine was regularly invoked by the, you might say, the Latin Church in the so-called Union Councils, notably the Council of Florence, but there had been others, the Council of Florence in the 15th century, where efforts had been made. In fact, for a while there was a heating of the schism between the East and the West. This was one of the crucial questions. Both sides believing there is a state of purgation after death. The Greeks, not following Augustine, following the Greek fathers, believing that it is not physical fire. And as a consequence, the definition of the Church in, for example, Florence or elsewhere, is never to speak of the fire of purgatory, but always simply of the pene, of the sufferings of purgatory, forbearing a declaration of the nature, the physical nature of the suffering. No one did the end of the world. This, by the way, the eschatology of Augustine on the end of the world, he is a science all by itself. Little known, and I should add, with a few qualifications that we'll make, common teaching in the Catholic Church, and not commonly known. First, about the end of the world, this scarcely needed emphasis, that the end of the world will come to an end. And there were no, you might say, polemic situations which Augustine had to defend, that the world will last forever. However, there is a position which Augustine expatiated on at length to the effect that the world will not really be destroyed, but rather changed. And that, I should add, when I teach this, as I do, we call this de novissimus in theology. When I teach in the theology, I emphasize, be sure to teach this. This is common Catholic doctrine, that the world will not, in the technical sense, be destroyed and go out of existence. It will be changed. And I have a passage here from the City of God. You notice the amount of City of God for this whole section of eschatology. Toward the end of the City of God, he's dealing, of course, with the City of God to come. It happens to be in the 20th book, the 14th chapter, in which he is talking about this phase. I have a quotation here. The form will pass away. That is the, well, the shape, the form, the way it is now, but not the nature. The nature of the present world will not change. No more, and this is good to know, no more than the body of man, which is material. See? First of all, it will be restored. And therefore, just as, and I'd say the certitude, while it has not been defined, but it is common teaching in Catholic theology, that just as the body of man will be restored to him and the union, therefore, with the spirit to last for eternity after the last day, so the material universe, see, will have its own death, so to speak, but not its destruction. It will not be annihilated. A new world will be made. And this new world, and this is in the same book 20, but here in chapter 16, he talks about the nature of this new world being suited to the new bodies that the human race will be incarnated with. Now this offers all sorts of opportunities given the theology. The theology is not just Augustine. It is, as far as we can say, Catholic. So the end of the world being certain, but that a new world will be created, or recreated, resurrected, so to speak. In other words, just as there will be a resurrection of the human body, there will be a resurrection of the world. See? To house, as it were, the humanities, including, of course, the humanity of Christ, in the new existence, of which, by the way, John speaks in the last chapter of his Apocalypse.
Will man be identified then with heaven?
A person's death, and the other after, or at the end of the world, they say, well, man has two sides to his being, an individual nature and a social nature. The particular judgment corresponds to his individual nature. The general judgment corresponds to his social nature, so that the whole world will know what this person did. If he was wicked and is condemned, that God's justice might be vindicated. If he did well, or at least if he is saved, that God's mercy would be glorified. That's the usual way of approaching this. Well, Aquinas has a brand new insight which tastes well. He says, you know, in the last analysis, no man's life or days is completely finished until the end of time. That we cannot really, really pass judgment on his goodness or his badness until the full import of the effects of what he did have been evaluated. And that takes more than a lifetime. It takes the lifetime of the world. And that consequently, the good that men did cannot really be judged, as far as they're concerned, all right, their state before God can be settled subjectively, because God knows that, obviously, at the moment of death. But although God foresees it, to really manifest, see, the true goodness, see, of the saints, the true wickedness of men who have been bad, you've got to see where the goodness, for example, through the example, through their writings, through impact, through influence, see? Generation unto generation, see? Like dropping a stone on a quiet sea and the ripples running out to the distant 1,000-mile shore. So that there has to be a general judgment, humanly speaking, to properly evaluate the good and the bad. It takes that long. At 6:58, we could say more. 6:59. He is here delineating the role of Christ in his human nature as judge. Because, as we know in the Gospels, Christ identifies himself, speaks of himself as Son of Man, as judging the world. Now, why should he, as the God-man, with emphasis on the humanity, be the judge and not merely God, who after all is the creator and master of human destiny? Well, he gives a number of good reasons. First of all, this is Aquinas. Notice, he is analyzing, see? He's going beyond the facts to study them. This is Aquinas. That's his mentality. He can never face a fact and just sit. He's got to look at it and figure it out. Well, he says it must be Christ in his human nature, because it is Christ in his humanity who is the giver of the graces which made goodness possible. So he has a right to judge, because it's because of him that people are saved. And not just, properly understood, God who saves man. It is Christ who saves man in his human nature, because had he not become man, man wouldn't be saved. So in other words, Christ has a right to pass judgment on that for which, in a way, he is responsible. Again, Christ, having through his mortal life experienced the gravest humiliation that God can experience, of being rejected by his own creatures, than which no humiliation can be greater. Now Aquinas said, he has coming to him the glorification that God has a right to. He's just biding his time. There will be another Calvary. In fact, Christ does speak, doesn't he, in Matthew's 25th chapter, of the cross, the sign at least appearing, which is usually interpreted to mean the cross. He'll somehow appear in the heavens, at least subjectively conceived. That's all that's necessary. You conceive everything subjectively. That Christ's humiliation in his death will be vindicated in his glorification, so that where he had been rejected by his creatures, he will perforce be recognized and as man, and that therefore his divinity will be acknowledged. Behind, in other words, the humanity which had been crucified, now that humanity will show itself in its majesty, then even those, see, who had during life deny the divinity of Christ will be forced to acknowledge it. And finally, and this ties in with so much, especially of Pauline theology, inasmuch as it was Christ who is the test of salvation, in other words, acceptance or rejection of him, at least by implication, is the condition for salvation. But why shouldn't he then be the one to judge? Since he was the criterion, he was the condition of being saved in the first place. This is noted something more than just the question of grace. Right? It was acceptance of Christ and of his teachings which saves, or the corresponding rejection of Christ and his teachings which would condemn. Well then he, the one who is, as he himself spoke of himself, as a stumbling block, who then should be the judge, inasmuch as it was acceptance or rejection of him that would be the condition of salvation. As again delineated in the 25th chapter, it was to me that you were kind when you gave food and drink and all the rest. You see? That's 659, 660. It's a takeoff on Augustine's description of heaven having to be eternal, because otherwise it wouldn't be heaven. We just wouldn't enjoy it. We'd always have to be suppressing the nasty thought, but this will end, but this will end. See? Well, from a slightly different angle, that there would not be, whatever else heaven is, it must imply perfect activity, the perfection of human actions. I will see in a few minutes what he identifies that perfect activity as. But whatever it is, the highest faculty operating on its highest object, somehow, must be heaven. He is not so much here concerned with duration as with nature or intensity. In 661, he analyzes what he stated in 660. What must be the essence of heaven? Now here, this is characteristic of Aquinas. And just to briefly state the thing without going beyond it, the term beatific vision is a consecrated term in Christian thought for the enjoyment of heaven. But now there are two ways of looking at it on those two terms representing a single concept. Vision, of course, corresponds by analogy with sight, seeing, in this case, of course, the mind. And the faculty of intellect is often, in fact, we don't, we say, I see something, well, your eyes may be closed when you see it, in the sense of understand it. Right? So the intellect corresponds spiritually to the bodily faculty of vision. So that's the mind. Vision corresponds to mind. Beatific, the adjective, coming from the Latin, beare, which means to be happy, or beatum facere, which means to make happy, corresponds to the faculty of the will, the appetitive faculty, the faculty of desire and enjoyment. Now, between those two stand two schools of theology in Catholicism and in medieval thought, the Franciscan and the Thomistic. The two combined, in fact, when the definition was coined by Benedict XII, anticipating further controversy, he said heaven is both. He wanted to make sure we have people both seeing God and enjoying the vision. Anyhow, Aquinas' emphasis is on the vision, that the essence of heaven is seeing God, and the consequence of that seeing is the happiness. See? Why so? Well, it needn't be belabored, except to be explained, because it doesn't offer an insight into the meaning of heaven. For him, the highest faculty of the human spirit is the mind. Now, there is a sense, of course, in which the will can be considered the highest faculty. Nevertheless, this is Aquinas, for whom the highest faculty is mind. And then, enjoyment is something which is consequent on that. So that the faculty by which I apprehend the real world, or better, in which I apprehend reality, is the intellect. And inasmuch as heaven, by Christian standards, is not the monistic oriental concept of some kind of a fusion of the two. See? There is always an other. God is always the other in heaven. The soul does not become God, or God, the soul. This is not Brahmanism. Christianity keeps the dichotomy clean. And Aquinas, being painfully aware of that, especially in his conflict with Islamic theology, which by that time had become pretty monistic, at least in certain of its dimensions, he insisted it must be the faculty of mind whereby I apprehend something which is not myself, but because it had reached the zenith of what it can know, then the enjoyment is the highest possible. But the enjoyment follows the knowledge. So vision is first, hence the substantive. Beatific, the adjective, is a consequence. So the word beatific is adjectival because it is consequential to the substantive, essential possession of heaven, which is a mental thing. Or, put more simply, the beatific vision is the possession by the highest faculty of its highest object. The highest faculty being the mind, the highest object being God. In 662, long section, he is here talking about resurrection. Could I ask somebody to keep up with me while in erasing? Joanne, would you mind, please? Thank you. The first part, please. Couple of. He distinguishes two kinds of resurrection. This, by the way, is one of his longest sections, and I wanted to summarize it. 662, which goes on through pages 404 to 407. Two kinds of resurrection. First, the spiritual of the soul. It is not common terminology, nevertheless, there is a very true sense in which a man's salvation, being saved, is a spiritual resurrection. Coming, in other words, into its own in the spirit, having been saved and rising from the death of sin. But there is, besides, another kind, which is bodily. Now it is this that he wants to expatiate on. The first, he says, by itself, as far as continued existence goes, is due to human nature. The spirit of man does not die. Once we come into the world, we cannot die. It's impossible, unless God would annihilate us. The soul is naturally immortal, as we teach. But the body, not so. The very fact that the two are conjoined, this is fundamental domestic thought. There is a basic tension or dichotomy between the two. The two are not naturally meant to be together. It is a gift in the first place that spirit and matter should be united. And when our first parents were made bodily immortal, it was a grace, a gift. They lost that gift through their sin. We've inherited their sin, therefore lost the consequences of the gift. Namely, we are mortal, bodily mortal. Now, the fact, however, that we do have a resurrection of the body, that although we die in body, we shall rise again in the body, is recognized from revelation. We know it's true because God so revealed it. And he appeals both to the Old Testament and the New. In the Old Testament, he rests this case on the book of Job, which I commend to your reading. Famous passages, for example, I know that my Redeemer lives, that I will see him, I myself, in this body of mine. Now, Aquinas was really wiser than he thought. He was not a rabbinic scholar. He was not much of he couldn't have been a modern exegete of the scriptures or a rabbinical thought. It is a simple fact that Jewish thought outside the scriptures, of which the book of Job just a little bit reveals it, had always believed in the resurrection of the body. B.C. Judaism believed in bodily resurrection. And even the 11th century Code of Maimonides, in other words, the Maimonides Code of the 13 articles of the modern Judaism, even there, I believe in the resurrection. So Judaism, this would of course be modern Orthodox Judaism, believes that man will rise again in body. This is, well, you know, the Jews believe it. In the New Testament, really it's in many places, but particularly those passages in which St. Paul especially speaks of we're dying with a mortal body and our rising with an immortal body. And that is particularly in the letter to the Corinthians, 15th chapter, first letter to the Corinthians. But now, most interesting is his analysis of the resurrection of the body from reason. Why, in other words, can we even, as far as the mind can this, can we say that there must be a resurrection of the body? He gives three reasons. First, inasmuch as we have been made a composite of a body and spirit, once the soul loses the body, or you name who loses which, the soul, although living, is in an unnatural state. It's human, all right, but hankering for that body that it was so familiar with and liked. In fact, the two closest companions have been body and spirit. There is a certain unnaturalness of the soul without a body. Therefore, there is, as it were, a kind of appetite, metaphysical appetite, on the part of the spirit for reunion with that which forms the human composite. Second, while heaven is, in a sense, complete happiness, even though the spirit alone would enjoy God, nevertheless, it is not so perfect as it would be if also body, and in other words, that soul remembering, knowing in fact that it is a human spirit, and having the capacity for a new kind of joy, which pertains to the body, if heaven is complete happiness in every sense of a human being and not merely of the human spirit, the body should also have its counterpart. Finally, and this is most interesting, the body has a right to it, because during life, who practiced the virtue? Well, might the body complain. Of course, it's not around to complain. How come? Look at all the mortification I practice. Look at all the self-control. How come you're getting all the reward and I'm rotting in the grave? I have a right to it too. In other words, inasmuch as both spirit and body worked out man's salvation, and how far, Aquinas asks, could the soul have gone without the body cooperating? You just try to practice virtue without the body's cooperation. Well,